Good morning.
Today's March 28th, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee and Human Services. Today is a continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526. Today we're taking public testimony on aging and people with disabilities, intellectual and developmental disabilities, and vocational rehabilitation. For everyone here, we have more than 60 people signed up. There's no way we are going to get to everyone today. So please bear with us as we go through as many people as we possibly can in the short time that we do have allotted for this committee. You can submit testimony online, and we would actually encourage you to do so if you are unable to speak or if the 2 minutes is not enough time for you to complete your entire testimony. We're going to try and take testimony from each individual, try and get as many people as we can from each of the individual groups, and you'll have allotted 2 minutes of time. Please keep your statements to 2 minutes, or if you can do it quicker, that's fantastic. But the more time that we can get through folks, the more folks that we can get to come up. So please respect that, and you will see the timer up here, which will go from green to red when it means your 2 minutes is up. And if so.
Good.
Oh,
and then,
Mr. Kocher, this is actually a warning. You'll see a yellow light before it's red, so you know your time's about up. And, Mr. Kocher, there are some people in overflow and hearing MC. So, as we call people up, we can try to give people notice that they're kind of on deck so they can get down here for testimony.
Yeah, and so what we'll do is we'll call the first three people down, and then we'll say who's on deck, just kind of like in baseball, if you will, and just know that please be ready and actually come in, and you could probably stand off to the side there to come up quickly to ease the transition. The first three people we will call up will be Sonia Fisher, Kendall Mason, and John Mullen. And when you get there, please begin when you're ready.
Oh, yes. She's a lawyer. And she's not a city councilor. She's elected.
Co-chair Sandra Hayward, co-chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Kendall Mason. I'm the legislative chair for the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities, and I'm also a policy strategist for SEIU Local 503. I'm here today to talk about our support as a coalition of organizations with the campaign for the APD budget. The proposed cuts to the budget are the reality of consistently making choices that benefit a few rather than doing what's right for Oregonians. The campaign opposes these reductions to rates at facilities that are facing increased costs because of the minimum wage and the near elimination of the Oregon Project Independence. Oregon's been a pioneer in long-term care for several decades, and as more people are entering retirement with fewer and fewer savings, we're facing a workforce crisis, and we should be looking to make serious and smart investments in our long-term care system and not cutting back. If Oregon wants to continue to be ahead of the curve to make sure Oregonians can live their lives with independence, dignity, and choice, we cannot defund the very programs that make us great. As members of the committee, you've already heard testimonies from agencies themselves regarding the state of their programs and the budget crisis they face. And you're well aware of the seemingly insurmountable work that must be done to not just prevent, but to innovate in our long-term care system. Now you're going to be hearing from a lot of real people who are on the other end of those choices in the legislature. And as you listen to their testimonies, I just ask that you consider the choice before you, which is to make sure that Oregon remains a national leader in long-term care or starts to lose ground in that leadership, because we can't figure out how to make sure everyone's paying their fair share.
I forgot to mention who was on deck. Thank you very much. It was Arthur Towers, Claudia Sage, and Jim Davis will be on deck. Please, Mr. Mullins.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And I also have been asked by the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition, Jeremiah Rigsby, to express the support of the Human Services Coalition for the current service level appropriation for all of DHS. And then specific to the APD budget, I want to testify on my own behalf, Oregon Law Center, and to begin by saying very much support the testimony that you just heard from Kendall. We participate in the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and for People with Disabilities. We try as much as possible to speak with one voice. In addition to what Kendall has mentioned about the budget and the need for revenue. We are really concerned about how a couple of things came out in the governor's recommended budget, even though they're different in the co-chair's framework. I want to call out two programs specifically. One is the 75% cut to Oregon Project Independence and the elimination of the pilot project serving younger people with disabilities. I've long been a supporter of getting to an age-neutral program for Oregon Project Independence, and the pilots were demonstrating good results, but nevertheless, a cut of 75% to OPI is just simply it's basically hard to conceptualize how that would actually work. We would lose a lot of people immediately from the program. And the second thing I'll mention very quickly is the general assistance program, which was also zeroed out in the governor's budget, though it's still part of the current service level, and we hope you'll give some special consideration to general assistance. Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Sonia Fisher, and I'm a Clackamas County Commissioner here to speak today on the impacts of the DHS budget on our residents in Clackamas County. I want to focus on three areas today, the first area being community choice waiver for children with significant disabilities, case management services, and then Oregon Project Independence. First of all, I do not envy the decisions that you have to make with the funding shortfall. It is really, really challenging, but I want to encourage you to look at things through the lens of community services, preventative services, and services that keep people in their families, in their communities, and in their homes. There's been a lot of talk on what to do with children with significant disabilities who have just entered receiving in-home community supports. In Clackamas County, we now have 652 children that are being served by the Community Choice Waiver, what is also called the K Plan. As a mother of a child who's now 32 years old, I can tell you that when my child was young, she was placed out of the home because we did not have services for children with significant disabilities. I want to encourage you to keep that lens, that without these services, children will leave their families, will leave their homes, and will be at a great cost, emotional and financial, to not only the families, but also to the state of Oregon. Secondly, I want to talk about case management services. Really important to not reduce the workforce model. And lastly, Oregon Project Independence. If it is cut, we will reduce services in Clackamas County from 120 residents to 50 residents. There are many citizens that depend on even a lifeline of $70 a month in order to receive the individualized supports that they need in order to remain in their homes. I want to encourage you to look through the lens of prevention, community services, and keeping people with their families.
Thank you all. Next up, Arthur Towers, Claudia Sage, Jim Davis, and then on deck is Sarah Williams, Brenda Talbot, Alicia DeLashmut, and Heather Oliver.
Okay, I'll start, I guess. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I wanted to come before you today to discuss funding adequate staffing and training for those staff in long-term care facilities. Our members fight for families and for victims of elder abuse, and sadly, I have to report that many of our members see growing incidence of elder abuse, a growing number of families coming to them, and more of our members focusing their practice on tackling elder abuse. Yeah, that's a tragic trend that I'm hoping that we can stop. Now, there needs to be a lot more accountability in this field, and we need to get to the bottom of what's causing the increase, whether it's demographics or if there's some other sort of change. But and we feel that we see only a small number of cases because these cases can be very difficult to bring, they can be very difficult to win. It takes a courageous and emotionally strong family to step forward in these cases when there can also be a tremendous amount of guilt about having to place the loved one in the facility where they were abused in the first place. The caregivers in these facilities do awesome work. They do the best they can with limited resources, and but they do have limited resources, and so improving staffing levels, improving the quality of care are important steps to take to avoid elder abuse. And I'll end my remarks there. Thank you very much.
Oh, hello. Good morning. My name is Reverend Dr. Claudia Sage, and I want to talk to you about Oregon Project Independence. As somebody who was independent, I was making over $100,000 a year. I have a PhD in epigenetics, which is a study of how the environment affects your genetic expression. Chemicals, pollutants, nutrition, stress, how does that affect your body's health? I became disabled when I contracted encephalitis. So I am now also a consumer of OPI because my medical bills approach $3,000 a month. And even though my income was once much greater, it doesn't work out when you consider the medical. And I think the Oregon Project Independence needs to continue, not just for my sake, but for other people who may be healthier, because we know there are clear evidence that how well-nourished a person is will impact how well they are health, how well their health is, genetically and psychologically and socially. How well do they feel about themselves, and how well do they feel about their bodies? And to remove Oregon Project Independence from people will leave them socially isolated and leave them socially at risk of becoming malnourished and having the oncogenes that cause cancer and some of the other genes that we don't want to activate turned on. Even something as simple as eating an apple. Apples contain acetylcholine, and they help with memory in somebody with depression and dementia. So I just want to bring that up to you today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, a geropsychologist and gerontologist who's been working in the system for 44 years now, representing the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, Oregon Disability Commission, the United Seniors of Oregon, and the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, all members of the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities. We are here today to express our very strong support for maintaining Oregon's nationally acclaimed senior and disability service system, which has become a national model for many decades, with among the lowest per capita expenditure in long-term care, often spending a half as much, a third as much than nursing care by keeping people in their own homes. Community service of this nature is a very cost-effective investment and save the state tens of millions of dollars. We strongly oppose any cuts to our programs. In particular, we are very dismayed at the dismantling of the Oregon Project Independence, which is a program that deals with people who do not qualify for Medicaid but are oftentimes near poor and falling through the cracks of the system. It has been a cornerstone of our system for over 40 years. We also want to bring to your attention the fact that in the governor's budget, there have been cuts recommended in general assistance program, elimination of the gatekeeper program, and certainly the flat rates of reimbursements for our long-term care residential care facilities are essentially cuts. So this is not a future direction that we want when we are looking at the fact that the senior population is going to double. Us boomers are going to double the population. Disability population is going to increase. We need to be ready for this. We ask for your strong support for senior and disability services.
Thank you all. Next up, Sarah Williams, Brenda Talbot, Alicia DeLashmet, and Heather Oliver. On deck will be Dale Penn, John Bartholomew, and Ruth Gullius. Probably pronounced that incorrectly. Please begin when you're ready.
Good morning. Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Rayfield, and members of the committee. My name is Alicia DeLashmut. I live in Portland, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to share what IDD and Medicaid supports do for my family. My fabulous 15-year-old daughter, Neva, was born with a rare genetic syndrome. Her gifts include being a gentle and understanding soul, a love of music and sports, and a stubborn streak that she comes from both naturally from her father and mother's side of the family. The effects of Neva's disability are widespread and complex and result in the need of 24/7 care for all of her activities of daily life, such as safety, personal care, and seizure management. Neva will need both paid and natural supports, her community and her family, for the entirety of her life. Regardless of her disability, she is a vital and much-loved part of our Portland community. Neva currently receives services under the Community First Choice K Plan. She accesses the funds provided from the K Plan to employ personal service workers that support her functional and safety needs in the community. Neva's PSWs actively work with her to build that community connection, friendships, and many skills that will benefit her later in life and reduce her need for system supports as an adult. Neva will require supports throughout her life, but starting to build her community as a youth through use of PSWs in the community is imperative for her success as an adult and necessary to reduce her future systems dependency to the highest extent possible. Reductions in the funding to the K plan will have catastrophic effects on my family and our daughter, and will eventually cost Oregon taxpayers more because our family will require expensive crisis services if Neva doesn't receive adequate supports. Reductions will leave my child and my family and many, many others at risk. Reductions will cut time Neva spends in the community learning life skills and building natural supports. Reductions will put our family and Neva at great risk of becoming isolated and segregated by the need to care for Neva. I urge you to fully support IDD services. As a family that experiences disability, we're just now getting back on our feet and heading in the right direction to becoming contributing, integral participants in our communities. Please don't fail our families now by setting back the clock for the disability community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair and Committee. My name is Heather Olivier, and I'm from Southern Oregon. 7 years ago, my son was diagnosed with autism. As a family, we found ourselves feeling very isolated. Unfortunately, we bought into the deficit of everything that he would not be able to do quickly, and we found ourselves feeling very isolated, very fearful, we just pulled away from family and friends. Fortunately, I had a service coordinator who said, I have two moms that I need to introduce you to. I cannot tell you their names, but I want you to show up at this parent meeting, and you guys will find each other. And that was the game changer for me as a parent. That moment of you two, of that shared experience for us, was the beginning of being a part of community again. As part of that connection with the community that were parents and happened to be moms that I connected with, I was able to become a part of our local family family network. And as part of that connection with the family network, what I realized is that it was important for our family to dream big dreams, because if we didn't dream those big dreams, then my son didn't have the model for dreaming those big dreams himself. As we met more parents and became connected with our community, what we found was that it changed our trajectory. It changed the outcome that our family and that my son would experience. What I can tell you now is he is dreaming those big dreams, that he is thinking about his future. And part of what family networks do is that they help enable families to be connected with their community, to reduce isolation, to be connected with supports and services that are appropriate for them, and to really feel like they are part of that. I'm actually the director of Family Network now, so I've gone through quite a bit of a change throughout the years, and I encourage you to fully support and fund Family Networks. Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Rayfield, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Talbot. I am from Corbett, Oregon. I am the single mother of a 13-year-old named Virginia who was born with a severe seizure disorder. I am grateful to the state that she is receiving case management services and support from Multnomah County Community Developmental Disability Program. We have been blessed with a case manager named Sarah, who without her, we would have been lost in the red tape and endless legal speak paperwork when applying for help. I cannot tell you how many times I've emailed, texted, and called her needing assistance with one form or another. My daughter would not be getting any help if it weren't for Sarah, as I'd not have filled something out correctly or submitted a form to the right place or checked the appropriate box. The amazing thing about her is I would never have known certain things were even available to my daughter if it weren't for her knowledge. For example, my daughter has to wear pull-ups. The cost on a weekly basis was a struggle. Sarah let me know Virginia was eligible to receive free pull-ups and they could be delivered to our home. I cried. I had no idea. I wouldn't have to worry about her at school or in public wetting herself. For the first time in my life, I'm terrified about what the future holds for my daughter. Put the shoe on the other foot. Imagine your own children and grandchildren's well-being literally hanging in the balance, because this is truly what is at stake. My child's and others who are the most vulnerable of us all. To cut funding to remove that one person who can help us parents navigate the confusing and frustrating governmental mumbo-jumbo to find peace and aid for our babies is unconscionable. Please, they are not a bottom line. They're not a dollar sign. They are children who need help. In any way, shape, or form, I ask you, I beg you to please do not reduce the funding and case management. We would be lost. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Hi, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Sarah Williams, and I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I'm here as a parent of a 9-year-old child. He is receiving case management services and support from Benton County Developmental Diversity Services. We have benefited from their services for a total of 4 years. My son has what they now call social communication disorder, previously known as Asperger syndrome. He's relatively mild on that spectrum, but parenting him has never been easy. I'm a single parent with my own disabilities. I receive APD services, by the way. Which interferes with my parenting activities. Most families enjoy, such as going on trips, going to the park, other social activities. Kids need to develop their skills, facilitating friendships for my son, and being physically active outside the home. I'm doing the best I can, and he's doing great, but we both couldn't have gotten here without a lot of help. When I first realized my son wasn't developing normally, I didn't know what to do, so I researched options and decided to have him do occupational therapy, which helped a lot, but we were still having a lot of problems at home and at daycare. By the time my son had gone through 4 daycares in a year, I finally decided I couldn't continue to work full-time. I quit my job to stay home with him. Then began the search for resources and ways to make it through. Thankfully, one of the first resources I discovered was Developmental Diversity Services. And once my son was approved for services, our case manager was key in several ways. Our case manager not only set my son up for in-home services, which was really, really important for us, that was through the PC20 system at the time, but she also helped us get signed up for a dance class designed for developmentally delayed kids. She got us information about signing up for parks and recreation scholarships and so many other important things. In our case, every little bit helped. The most important thing she did for us, though, was helping my son get his SSI benefits started. We had little income at that point because I wasn't working, and we were about to lose our apartment. The second most important thing she did for us was to help us get into housing we are now in. And that without her, we would have been homeless. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you. So we'll call up Dale Penn, John Bartholomew, and Ruth Gullius. I'm sure you'll correct me. On deck will be Sarah Noack, or N-O-A-C-K, Karen Londell, and Ross Ryan.
Hi, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dale Penn. I'm here as a member of the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities, as well as the co-chair of the Human Service Coalition of Oregon's Tax and Revenue Committee. During the 2013 legislative session, the campaign and HISCO worked closely with legislative leadership to agree upon changes to the state's senior medical tax deduction. Oregon was the last state in the nation to maintain this program, and it was expected to cost the state over $82 million in lost revenue in the 13-15 budget cycle and an ever-increasing amount going forward. Advocates and lawmakers agreed to changes that would capture those savings and redirect half the money to several key investments to seniors and people with disabilities. In the last two biennia, $41 million each cycle was invested into programs for seniors and people with disabilities for Oregon's most vulnerable populations as a result of that senior promise. Over $10 million per biennium of that funding was allocated to transit districts via the Special Transportation Fund that specifically went towards senior and disabled transit services. This agreement has also provided vital resources into Oregon Project Independence, caregiver training, the Gatekeeper Program, senior and disability mental health and addiction specialists in counties across the state, and many other important programs. These are programs with amazing results. These are programs that provide education to unpaid caregivers who are dealing with the challenges of Alzheimer's or related dementia, helped establish the state public guardianship program for incapable adults, allowed for the expansion of OPI to a younger disabled population. These investments are all focused on adhering to the goals behind Chapter 410 of Independence, Choice, and Dignity. We are asking that you remember that senior promise and continue your track record of investing scarce resources into these vital programs. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Co-chairs Steiner Raynard and Rayfield and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I am Ruth Gullius, CEO of Leading Age Oregon, representing not-for-profit and other mission-directed providers of long-term services and supports throughout the state of Oregon. With me is Donna Braymiller, a member of ours who operates a faith-based CCRC in Albany, as well as manages Corvallis Caring Place. I wanted to speak real briefly about the Medicaid rates by telling the story of one of our members, Willamette Manor, who is a 42 assisted living community in Lebanon. And their story is one that really illustrates the inadequacy of current Medicaid rates, particularly in view of the rising resident acuity, the present workforce crisis, and increasingly competitive environment. Willamette Manor is funded through Oregon Housing. They have to have a high Medicaid population, usually about 60%. They often manage about 70%, making it extremely difficult. They're often in... They often have 70%. They often have an annual deficit of about $40,000 to $80,000 on an annual basis that they work very diligently to offset through a variety of fundraising activities. She estimates that the current rate is about current Medicaid rate is about $20 less on a daily basis than what they need to provide quality care and services. She also spoke to the increase in acuity and related service needs of residents, which really widens the gap then between what Medicaid pays for and what they're able to provide. Due to recent changes made to need thresholds for Medicaid eligibility, a resident that was recently assessed has to move out because he's no longer Medicaid eligible, despite the fact that he's lived there for 4 years, is on dialysis, is in a wheelchair, he refuses help with bathing, and dressing that the committee once provided because he wants to maintain his dignity and independence. He does get help on dialysis days, but because he doesn't do it as regularly, he's going to have to move out. She indicated one of her greatest challenges is finding caregivers in an already challenging workforce environment because of what she's able to pay based on her Medicaid rate. She has difficulty competing with other communities that are able to pay more due to their size, either lower Medicaid, no Medicaid. So that's another challenge for her rates. As you build the budget and consider the budget solutions, we ask that you really consider the inadequacy of the Medicaid rates. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning. My name is Donna Braymiller. I'm from the Mennonite Village in Albany, Oregon. Currently, our community is the second largest CCRC in the state. We're one of only two that participates in Medicaid. The majority of CCRCs are private pay only. I just wanted to briefly talk about the impacts of Medicaid and our overall operating budget. Currently in our nursing facility, 55% of the permanent long stay residents are on Medicaid. The price difference between a Medicaid resident and private pay can be as much as $4,000 a month. So you can do the math. That results in private pay residents pay more than their cost of care, which only depletes their resources more quickly. In May, our community is going to be doing groundbreaking on a new nursing facility. The end result is for the majority of suites to have private bathrooms and showers in each living unit. The goal is for all residents, regardless of their payer source, to be able to live in a private dwelling. in our community-based care areas, both in assisted living and in memory care. We do currently screen and ask that residents can pay privately for up to 18 months. That's becoming more and more difficult. We are having to turn more people away because they're not able to pay privately. In our assisted living building, 17% of our current residents are there, and they are on Medicaid. The new challenge with Medicaid eligibility, it's no longer a given that you deplete your resources that you're automatically going to qualify. You also have to be physically dependent enough to be able to be eligible for Medicaid. Currently, we have two residents living in our assisted living that are out of money, but they aren't dependent in a physical way, so our foundation is having to cover them. In memory care, 34% of our residents are on Medicaid. There are no price distinctions in Medicaid for memory care, so if a resident has behavioral issues, we're required to pay for the 24-hour provision of care with no additional resources. We just ask that as you have to look at the pie, that you really think about senior services and the impact of Medicaid funding, especially for community-based care in the state of Oregon.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon, a membership organization with over 500,000 members in the state. You have written testimony for me, so I'll be very brief. I just wanted to highlight a few things that as a member of the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities, you've heard from a number of us already this morning. I'd like to echo all those comments and highlight that Oregon Project Independence is a major issue for AARP as well. On another angle for it is the support for family caregivers. As many of you know, we had a work group on caregiver respite last summer, and many of you have seen the report that came out of that. OPI is one of those programs that can also make sure that family caregivers don't burn out because they can get a short break from taking care of their loved ones while they're getting support through the OPI program. So that is one of the things we care deeply about. Also, for those family caregivers, caregiver training. Caregiver training is something that was funded through the what we call the senior spa that Dale Penn spoke about. Oregon Care Partners is actually doing that caregiver training that allows for folks to really understand how best to care for their loved ones. With dementia, if you have, there's often difficult behaviors that come with that. And you can learn how to manage these things. And finally, I would note that something that was originally part of that special package that was then cut in 2015 is the Gatekeeper program. Gatekeeper trains people in the community to keep their eyes on vulnerable community members. And we'd love to see that program return. It's low cost, high impact, and we'd love your support for that as well. So thank you for your time. Thank you. So next up, Sarah Nowak, Karen Londell, Ross Ryan. On deck will be Bobby Yambasa, Stephanie Jackson, and Sam Rutledge. And just please note, as you're coming up, if I've only called three people, only have the 50 folks that I've called up. I know that there's sometimes a group of you that want to testify together, but we're going to take things in a different way. So please begin when you're ready.
My name is Karin. I'm here to represent OSAC.
And for the record, I'm Sarah Nowak. Karin has asked me to ask her some questions today. Although Karin receives IDD services, neither I nor the organization I represent receives funds to support Karin. Karin, what is the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition?
Oregon Self-Advocate Coalition is made out of 18 groups in Oregon, and they are self-advocates.
And what is OSAC's vision for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
They want to get jobs in the state of Oregon and work like anybody else in the community.
Why is it important for people with IDD to be members of their community?
Because they want to get out and work and not sit at home and be like anybody else in the community.
You recently used DD services to get some skills training to ride the bus. Can you explain that?
Yes, I got training by Wise to train me to get to my work and I take two buses to go, and I think is a wonderful thing because I need to get out of the house, and I need to keep busy like anybody else out in the community.
How has knowing how to ride the bus changed your life?
It makes me independent. It makes me want to go and take the bus again.
And what's your advice for people with IDD?
Don't be afraid. Go for it.
How have DD services changed your life?
It makes me grow because the DD services can really help you navigate jobs, and it will help us be more independent.
I'm Ross Ryan. I'm representing OSAC and a group called the Fairfield Trust Committee.
And again, for the record, my name is Sarah Nowak, and Ross has asked me to ask him some questions. What does Fairview Trust mean to people with IDD?
It means that it was a promise for Oregon that we can be independent within our own homes, and that the houses would be IDD ready.
Why is it important for you to live in your community?
If we don't live in our community, we are not being contributed, and you'll be saying that we are second-class citizens.
Why is it hard to find housing for people with IDD?
It's too expensive to live on our own, and the housing market keeps on increasing the rent and stuff.
If we don't have affordable housing, what happens?
We'd be out in the street, or having group homes would be more expensive, or worst case scenario would be with our parents or accessing the emergency care system to access what we need.
You are a member of the Fairview Trust Advisory Committee. How does that group see the trust helping people with IDD?
The Fairview Trust Committee means that we are looking at having a set amount of money with two separate accounts. The 5% would go to contractors that could provide IDD housing, and the rest of the money will go towards other things, and the bulk of the money will stay in and increase the interest.
Okay, Ross, how do you feel about the trust being zeroed out?
If we zero the trust, we cannot be independent.
Okay. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Nowak, and I'm the brokerage director at United Cerebral Palsy of Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm here today to ask that you continue to fully fund brokerage case management services. Brokerage services assist adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities to live the life that they choose in their own or family homes in the community. We do this through person-centered, individualized access to resources so that a person may become more independent and connected to their community. One of the things we do best is to honor and support the choices that a person makes around important life decisions. Our role is to provide as much information as possible so a person may make a decision with resources in hand to move forward in their life in an informed and safe way. We are a hub of information and navigators of a complex service delivery system. Oregon committed to serving citizens in the community when we closed Fairview. That was the right choice then, and it's the right way now. It does require continued investment to assure that people are living the life that they choose and to secure health and safety. In addition to being key players in Oregon's vision for our communities, brokerage case managers help people follow laws, avoid bad actors, get mental health and alcohol and drug supports, and medical care. In our current climate of fiscal uncertainty, a strong infrastructure of case management will be needed to help people figure out how to meet their needs with fewer resources. Strong case management meets health and safety concerns in a planful way and saves precious, costly resources. So again, I'm here today to ask for your continued commitment to fully funding case management services. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Up next is Bobby Yambusa, Stephanie Jackson, Sam Rutledge. On deck is Brenda Tuck, Dorothy, and there's no last name, and then Cheryl.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Jackson. I have been a case manager for Senior Disability Services in Eugene for 2 years. I'm also represented by SEIU. I currently work with about 100 seniors and people with disabilities who receive services in their home through Oregon's groundbreaking in-home service program, the first of its kind in the nation. Oregon has a long and proud history of providing its most vulnerable citizens with innovative in-person-centered options that allow them to live safe and fulfilling lives in their homes. This is the level of service that many people have come to expect and depend on to meet their most basic needs. These services are vital not only to the health and safety of those we serve, but also to the quality of life our fellow Oregonians are able to receive and enjoy. The proposed cuts to our budgets has generated much fear and anxiety amongst the people I serve. I receive emotional phone calls and questions daily about how this will affect their ability to get the medical care they need, the medications they rely on, and the help of their home care worker that is often vital to their ability to not only stay alive, but to live with dignity and freedom of choice. The fear and pain I hear in these conversations reiterates how important the services we provide are to the people who depend on them. Those of us who work within senior and disability services see every day both the strengths and weaknesses of the programs we manage. However, we also get to see how successful and fundamental these services are to meeting the basic health and safety needs of those we serve. Many that I serve would be homeless, uncared for, both medically and physically, or even dead without the services we provide. The tragedies that would unfold if many of them lost even a minimal amount of the support they currently receive would be both devastating and embarrassing, and would cause great harm to some of the most vulnerable individuals and families across the state. Any cut to services or staffing would be unbelievably damaging. As a social worker, I have an ethical responsibility to do no harm. Any further cuts to our programs would make upholding that responsibility almost impossible. I'm here today to ask you, the leaders of our communities, to get brave and creative in identifying and following through with alternative funding sources. I'm here asking you to commit to the people you serve and people above all.
I apologize, but the time is up. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Sam Rutledge. I'm a member of SEIU and also an adult protective services specialist. I work for LCOG, but here is myself. I'm here to talk to you about my experience as a day in the life of an adult protective services specialist. As you all are facing tough choices between essential services and competing priorities, I hope that you end up seeing how adult protective services provides a first and a last line of defense for our state's most vulnerable adults. But we're part of a safety net, and our work becomes harder when other parts of that net are cut. So what we need from you is to work courageously at solutions that will fully fund the state's safety net programs. So part of my job is screening. I work on a screening hotline, and people call us on the worst day of their lives. And these calls are tense, and emotions run high. My job is to be professional, empathetic, and efficient. When I started doing this 3 years ago, a busy day brought around 19 new referrals. Today, we often process more than 30. Still, we take pride in treating each caller with a high level of service and dignity and respect. With as many as 20 new cases each month for an adult protective services worker, keeping up with report writing is also a challenge. Our reports need to be thorough, concise, and timely, and the attention to detail we put into these reports can make the difference between an abuser facing a conviction or walking free. It can decide whether a care facility is held accountable for neglecting senior citizens when we're not thorough, wrongdoing continues, and we take this responsibility very seriously. I'm going to give you some written testimony that includes some stories of people who I visited with, but I don't have time to speak to you about that today. But I just want you to know that that the state needs our services, that we protect the most vulnerable people, that we see this as both a moral responsibility and a practical concern, and that I urge you, again, in the strongest possible terms, to search and to scour every possibility for new funding solutions, because we have to keep these programs intact. Thank you.
Thank you. The next three up are Brenda Tuck, and again, Dorothy with no last name, and then Cheryl with no last name. On deck will be Terry, looks to be Horton or Houchin, Jim Murray, and Cheryl Malmsten.
Hi, my name is Brenda Tuck, and I am a DSP for Community Access Services. I was once told that if your work seems like work, you're in the wrong kind of work. Well, that does not apply to me. I love my job, and I've been doing it for 7 years. The problem is that because we don't have the staffing, my schedule is one day shift, one swing shift, and two graveyards. And the rest of the time is varied because I am the medical lead in their home, and I make sure they get to their appointments and get all their paperwork in order for that. I sometimes work 60 or more hours a week, and the problem is that even with all those hours, I am still living in a motel room with my 7 children, children and grandchildren. And we can't afford to get into a house because we can pay the rent, but we can't pay the bills. I want to be able to not have to choose whether to spend time with my family or provide for my family. And with the money that we make right now, that's just not possible. I have to make a choice. It makes it even harder because my 15-year-old daughter has disabilities of her own, which makes her anxious when she can't be with me. And my 8-year-old grandson also has disabilities, and he's in special classes. So without the support and nobody wants to work at a company that they just can't make the money. Not everybody can handle it like me. I'm actually going to school online so that I can get my bachelor's degree just in case I can't get my family out of the situation they're in. And I don't want to have to make that choice. Thank you.
Good morning. So, Chad and Hayward co-host with the men of the community. My name is Sarah Kewell. You have been gentlemen if you like to follow along. I'm 7 years using presentation as a girl. I didn't like it yet. Now I live in my own apartment in Portland. I have help from my friends. I have used it for 12 years. My siblings are important to me. I have appreciation from a book reach and 2 people to help me. They take me to my medical appointments. They help me to do the things I want to do. Please keep my book service card. Please don't cut my service for people that need saving.
Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, and members of the committee. My name is Dorothy Coughlin. I live in Wilsonville. For the past 16 years, my sister Barbara has been served by direct care staff at Partnerships and Community Living. I'm recently retired after 36 years in the field of disability. My testimony speaks most specifically to the reality of direct care staff who provide critical services for pay that for years has not been commensurate with the complexity of care needs that they address daily. My concern is not only on behalf of my sister, but for all of our Oregonians who are dependent on others for their care. My sister is diagnosed in the profound range of intellectual disability. She lives with epilepsy, is mobility impaired, and requires 24-hour care. Barb also loves to sing, goes to work each day, has a great sense of humor. Is the first to remind everybody to pray before we eat. She loves to hold baby nephews and has been and is my best teacher. To care for Barb, staff need to administer 25 different medications each day, assist with bathing, toileting, dressing, prepare mechanically soft meals, monitor eating to prevent aspiration, assist with safe transfer from her wheelchair multiple times a day, take her for water therapy each week, plan and provide for community activities, attend multiple medical appointments, keep informed of Barb's 8 protocols for crisis response, get her up twice each night to go to the restroom, write daily log reports, track seizures, along with caring for 4 other housemates who too have multiple complex needs that with age increase in complexity. Staff ratio is 2 staff for a community of 5 adults. Add to that every day laundry, grocery shopping, house cleaning, meal preparation. With a pay scale of $10.50 an hour, maxing at $15 an hour, it is not surprising the difficulty in finding and retaining staff or staff working overtime to cover for vacancies. From a family perspective, in light of the complex needs and the necessity of trained, experienced staff, I'm concerned about the safety of my sister and others with intellectual and developmental disabilities, especially those who have no family or caring person to advocate for them. The benefit of consistent relationships.
I'm going to apologize here. The time has expired. So please submit the rest of your testimony.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're going to call up Terry, and the last name starts with an H. I can't necessarily make out the last name. Jim Murray and Cheryl Malmsten. On deck will be John Cook, Julia Cook, and Twinda, I believe, Whitehead. So I may, or there might be a beginning to that I've messed up as well. So.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jim Murray. I'm a retired CPA and the volunteer treasurer for Tillman Community Action Resources Enterprise CARE, a local nonprofit social services organization whose programs include emergency assistance, homeless services, support for first-time parents, and assisted living for seniors. I am speaking on behalf of CARE. Tillamook CARE owns and operates 2 nonprofit assisted living facilities, Kilch's House in Tillamook and the Halem Bay House. We serve approximately 60 residents, the vast majority of which are low-income seniors receiving Medicaid. We have 34 full-time equivalent employees between the 2 communities. These facilities are currently operating at a break-even, provided we maintain close to full occupancy. This leaves little, if any, funds for needed capital expenditures or other expenditures. The recently approved increases in minimum wage will make it impossible for us to continue operating these facilities without substantial increases to the Medicaid reimbursement rates. The wage increases alone represent a 3.5% to 5% increase each year in our annual costs. Other costs will also rise with inflation, food, etc. Current Oregon state budget proposals are for flat funding long-term care Medicaid reimbursement rates. You don't have to be a financial genius to see this is a formula that will soon result in closing these facilities, forcing low-income residents to move out of their communities to try and find services elsewhere. Please increase the Medicaid reimbursement rates to cover higher costs, food, clothing, utilities, and in particular, high labor costs you enacted through the minimum wage law. We do not want our residents to be without a place to live in their communities and to be without essential services. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Cheryl Malmsten, and I'm here Wanted to say hello to both Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and good morning to Co-Chair Rayfield and the others of you that are members also of this committee. So I'm a DSP, Direct Support Provider with Shangri-La, and I've been doing that for a few years now. I listed out a few things that I do on a typical day. So I'll start with that it's my job. There's ISP goals, so individual support plans for these people. Those can include assuring that the five people in the home where I work, that they're, you know, having the chance to do a weekly tour, having a chance to, maybe it's their goal to go on one cruise that year or something in between those two, like go on a hike. So with those, there's about approximately, when you add the five people, 40 to implement for that year, and then maybe 10 weekly with the five people if each person had two. So we operate with one and sometimes two in the home to have that be done. As a lead DSP, I help train new employees. So as I'm training them, we do things like administer medications, as you heard earlier today. We help with food preparation. We shop for the groceries, so weekly, or it could be my job to do that every 3 weeks. We set medical appointments, so we're going, making sure they, in the home I'm at, there's like five ladies, so they might have a yearly mammogram, a colonoscopy, they could have physicals. So it's just my job to make sure that those appointments are being done, and the state comes, as you know, and check things out one time every 2 years. So I also brought like a family of three and then a family of five, funding what it costs, and there's basically a shortfall in the budget that I did for a family of three by 678. So that would mean second job, and with a five, there's a shortfall of approximately $1,500. So thank you for your time today, each of you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Terry Hayden. I'm from Corvallis. I'm a live-in 24/7 home care worker. It was brought to my attention that they wanted to take my position and split it into three parts. I did the math. I crunched the numbers. It doesn't add up. And then it was brought to my attention that I had used the wrong figure. I had used the $9.75 per hour instead of the $14.50 per hour, which makes it even worse. The difficulty that I have with my client, who's also my domestic partner, by the way, she has to be awakened every 2.5-3 hours in the middle of the night to aerate her ileostomy bag. Otherwise, takes on the whole new meaning of shit happens. She also has an upper pubic urine bag. She also has cerebral palsy, so she's wheelchair-bound completely. And to bring somebody else in to take care of her, I do have good backup caregivers, but I figured it out using three caregivers. Doesn't even count the weekend, which amounts to overtime. So it's a big chunk of change if you're going to increase from one home care worker to three or four, if you can find the fourth one for the week, weekend. Home care workers are getting very hard to find, particularly that are qualified. And I think that's about all that I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up would be John Cook, Julia Cook, Twinda Whitehead. I believe that's her. Okay, all right, just making sure. Then I've got Robert Nash, David Abramowitz, or Abramowitz, and then Jeannie Barter.
All right, good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rainfield. Committee members, my name is Julia Cook. I am testifying in front of you today for my brother and family. I live in Redmond. I'm a personal support worker with Deschutes County. My brother was born developmentally disabled and diagnosed with autism at a young age. My brother cannot communicate his medical needs. He is far too trustworthy of strangers. He also needs constant reminders of everyday affairs, including mealtimes. He will never live on his own for these and many more reasons. It's all right, though. I know his needs. I recognize when he's in pain. He really can't find the words to say it for himself. When he's sad, he comes to me. And when he's scared, it is me he only trusts. While my brother can't make his own decisions and act correspondingly about when he's hungry and other ordinary life events and common emotions that most of us in this room truly take for granted on a daily. Our state and this legislative body faces an important decision now between funding programs that allow my brother to stay in the dignity of our home, along with living wages and benefits that allow me to provide that care, or permitting Oregon to continue to have one of the nation's lowest corporate tax rates. We all make choices and live with related consequences every single day. Let's continue to lead the whole nation in delivering home and community-based care services. I am so proud and so fortunate to live in a state where my brother's rights are protected and care programs are available. Family members like me may give their loved ones the care needed to be healthier and happier. In my opinion, it is my brother's right to live exactly where he chooses and with whom he wishes. It is really his choice for him to live at home with his sister and to have the care necessary for him to live as independently as possible. While the state and
Ms. Cook,
yes.
I'm sorry, your time is up.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will submit my thank
please
you.
Do. Yes, please do.
Good morning, Co-Chair Senator Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. I'm John Cook, and I live and work in Bend. My sister, Julia, is also here today testifying on behalf of our brother. I care for our other brother, Andrew. I have cared for him for the last year. Andrew is legally blind, deaf, and developmentally disabled. He has multiple chronic health issues requiring constant observation and care. I help him manage his pain and diabetes. His pain comes from injuries occurred in care facilities and more recently a history of blood clotting from an auto accident, including a torn rotator cuff. He also has intermittent breakouts of staph infection. It took the state of Oregon 2.5 months before they could actually start paying me for Andrew's care. Frustratingly, I worked for free those 2.5 months. The Department of Human Services, because of years of budget cuts and the wrong choices our state makes every day about who and who doesn't pay for vital public services, which includes caring for our disabled brothers. Originally, they expected my mother and I to share 125 hours a month for Andrew's care. That's when we had a home health care nurse come in to and assess his daily needs and outline my mom's daily care tasks. The nurse requested more hours for his care from Andrew's caseworker at full access in Bend. During the meeting with Andrew's caseworkers, we finally able to get 196 hours for his care. I split those hours with my mother. I worked 156 hours and my mom did the other 40. These hours save the state money, as my brother would end up in an expensive facility if he were not cared for in the home program. We were only paid for these hours for 2 months. Until the state budget cuts hit my family. Since the Department of Human Services does not have enough case managers to keep up with the growth of its ever-expanding and rapidly growing caseloads, many of care providers don't receive the individual assistance we need as folks living at or near poverty line in many cases. Because of the stresses and unmanageable workloads associated with those, the state workers working with home care workers and corresponding lack of raises deserving of these hardworking frontline case managers.
Oh, your time is up.
Thank
I
you.
Apologize.
Sorry.
So thank you. And please submit your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share my testimony today. And for the record, my name is Twenda Whitehead.
I got it right.
Very good. That's unusual. I happen to be a new SEIU member, and I am a personal support worker from Curry County, Brookings, Oregon. It has been recognized that the state of Oregon is a leader regarding in-home care. It is my hope to ask that the budget crisis we are currently in does not jeopardize the critical services for mentally and intellectually disabled, as well as other individuals that rely heavily on these services. The risk of improper funding is putting an already vulnerable, underserved population at risk if funds are not allocated to these services. The state of Oregon takes pride of being a leader in home care, and in order to continue taking the lead, we need to make sure our services are properly funded and supported to assure the best quality of care for the people we care for. I have a little bit of a deviation I want to make here because I'm speaking as a PSW, but it's really my daughter that I take care of, and so I want her voice to be heard. And she's a 35-year-old individual that we moved to Oregon a couple years ago because we did some research, and it seemed that her brother was already here, and Oregon was leading in the nation according to other states. Amanda had suffered abuse and assault in a group home setting, and me and my son have taken it upon ourselves to care for her in her home. She is profoundly disabled and has suffered many, many horrible, horrific situations within the care of unsupervised situations within other entities of care, not to throw mud. But my time's up. I will submit this online, and thank you.
Thank you. Next up is David Abramowitz, Gene Barter, and Robert Nash. On deck will be Shane Clay, Jasper Smith, and Alice Massey.
Good morning. My name is David Abramowitz from Eugene, Oregon. And I'm in my second term as a member of the State Rehabilitation Council. And in the time I have before you today, I want to follow up on Vocational Rehabilitation Director Trina Lee's presentation to you yesterday. And just to add to this, I could easily also be with the DD Coalition and Services for the Aging. So it's all together here. Voc Rehab, by comparison, is a small program within DHS, but it has a big impact on the lives of the people in our state who experience a disability. I have worked in the field for about 36 years. I started in 1975, so I've seen a lot evolve over the last 40-plus years. And I've seen the evolution of Voc Rehab in Oregon over these past 40 years. 40 years in which so much has changed in the world of opportunity and services for people with disabilities. Additionally, the expectations on Voc Rehab have risen significantly as well. In the upcoming funding cycle, Voc Rehab has two significant challenges regarding youth with disabilities through the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act and transition age youth and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Back in 1990, the Youth Transition Program was born with the University of Oregon, Oregon Department of Ed, and with Vocational Rehabilitation. In those 27 years leading up, starting with seven high schools, we're now at 120 high schools and over $1 million, millions of dollars over that period of time of federal match and thousands of students served. And the only reason I mention that is that that's the foundation that now Voc Rehab can work off of to start meeting the expectations of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. But those expectations that come with Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, if you don't mind, I'm going to say we owe instead of saying that every time, still has a significant added cost of time and effort of existing staff. I'm done already.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is John Barter, and I'm representing the State Rehab Council as well. I'm on my second term. I am also a retired Voc Rehab counselor, and I I just want to stress that the importance of our service delivery system is based upon finding comparable services and benefits to assist Oregonians with disabilities in either obtaining or maintaining employment. Because we have the comparable benefit rule, we become very adept at finding services within the community. We work with many of the other agencies, workforce boards, the DD services, the senior and disabled services, and mental health companies to assist in placing people to work. We've also doubled up with VA, and the only time we spend VR dollars is when we can't find dollars somewhere else. It's a cause that's near and dear to my heart because I not only am a retired VR counselor, I actually was a client of Oregon VR. And Oregon VR helped me get a job after a rather significant and devastating motor vehicle accident several decades ago that placed me on disability for a while. I had spinal cord injury, brain injury, and crushed pelvis, and my medical rehab took about 5 years. Oregon VR was there to help me. They helped me find all the services in the community that would assist me in going back to work, assisted me in finding a part-time job in the community. I was eventually able to go to full-time work and become totally self-supporting. And for that, I just hope to continue to pay it forward. Thank you.
My name is Robert Nash. I'm here with SEIU. My wife and I have three homes in Central Oregon, in Deschutes and Cook County. We take care of developmentally disabled individuals. And the recent raise in the minimum wage has caused a crisis in our home. We are currently reimbursed at their one-on-one rate of about $10.70 an hour. We pay $12 an hour minimum wage. That creates a ripple effect of about $120 a day goes out of our budget, and our budget has to be balanced in other ways. And so it happens that we will have to cut expenses in things like property repair, house expenses, and those things to make up for what we pay in extra payroll. So what I'm asking today is that there would be reimbursement increase to match the increase in the minimum wage. That when the minimum wage goes up, that the reimbursement rates that comes to DD Home for one-on-one services would match that. Not only do we have to raise the minimum wage, but we pay 18% payroll tax on whatever that would be. So it adds more than, when it goes up $2, we have paid $2 plus 18%. Which puts us in a predicament that makes it very difficult to survive in our business. Thank you.
Thank you. This next panel will be our final panel, as most of us have a firm 10 o'clock appointment. So I do apologize for the folks that were unable to testify today. Please do submit your written testimony. We know that this is very important to all of you, and we apologize deeply that we can't get to everybody. But the next panel is Shane Clay, Jasper Smith, and Alice Massey.
Good morning, and I would like to say that I had a situation at one time, and drinking a little too much, and with the help of the community, Betty Bundy, my friend, she's a service coordinator. That's what I was trying to get at. Sorry about that. But what I was going to say is, with her help, I had a meeting with my stepmom and my dad, and I'm going now to AA meetings like on Mondays, and as of today, I'm 160 days sober.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Great.
And also, I was just going to say right fast that also at one time I had like two ladies that was working, that I was working with, in other words, and I liked one real well, and at the time I had to kind of, you know, go along with another lady, and which I done as the best I could, and then luckily it worked in my favor to where I got to go back with the first lady, and I guess that's about all I know on that, so thank you very much for your time.
I'm Jasper Smith, representing the Benton County Developmental Diversity Program. We support children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in our community. We started in 1971 as a pilot project of what was called the Services Coordination Model. It was a great success, and 2 years later, it was adopted statewide and became what we know today as Community Developmental Disability Programs, or CDDPs. Since we began in Oregon, services coordination has been the key to building community-based support that has allowed people with disabilities to thrive in our communities with the support they need for housing, jobs, transportation, and participation in community life. Along the way, four large institutions have been closed, and 10 times as many people are supported well in the community than were supported poorly in institutions for a relatively similar cost to the state. Services coordination has been consistently proven to be probably the most successful approach to achieving the triple aim. In every population where it has been applied, the outcome to the well-being of the person supported has improved, and the cost to the system has dramatically declined due to significant decreases in hospitalization, incarceration, emergency room visits, homelessness, and institutionalization. Services coordination in the DD system saves money not only for DD, but also for other DHS programs, OHA, education, corrections, and law enforcement. Services coordination is the backbone of our system. It should be the first thing funded and the last thing cut in any budget scenario, and should be introduced to any support system that does not have it. The systems that have poor or non-existent services coordination or case management are consistently the most expensive with the worst outcomes. The United States has the most expensive health care in the world and the worst outcomes in the developed world. Other countries achieve better outcomes at lower cost by investing in social services like services coordination. Investing in services coordination saves the state money. The right support at the right time is much less expensive than the wrong support at the wrong time. Cutting services coordination costs more money and creates human suffering, as people who can be supported successfully in the community end up in hospital beds, emergency rooms, jail cells, and homeless shelters when they lose support.
Good morning. I'm Alice Massey, Program Manager for the Eastern Regional IDD Program in Pendleton, which serves children and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities in the 14 counties of Eastern Oregon. There are four other similar regional programs in Oregon. Regional programs offer both pre-crisis and crisis services. Pre-crisis services include training and behavior consultation to help stabilize challenging behavior and equip providers and families to offer quality supports. Our crisis services help access needed resources at critical times, often to help prevent individuals from ending up in hospitals or jails. Regional programs are the last available resource to help resolve crises and secure emergency placements. Stabilization and Crisis Unit, SACU, is usually full and relies on the regional programs to find community placements for individuals needing discharge from SACU in order to free up beds for new admissions. All five of the regional IDD programs are slated for elimination in the governor's proposed budget. Eliminating these programs will leave a void, as much of what we do is direct service and cannot, per Medicaid rule, be absorbed and provided by case management entities. Additionally, rural regions of the state will be disproportionately affected, as there are far fewer community resources available to provide even a small portion of these services. This loss could easily destabilize situations for many people with IDD and result in increasing numbers of people going into crisis. Rather than eliminating regional programs, we request that the funding be reduced with any amount commensurate with reductions given to CDDPs for the coming biennium. Maintaining even a smaller amount of regional services can continue to provide a critical safety net for many people with IDD, diverting them from out-of-home placements, hospitals, and jails. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a piece of working trivia. When Jasper was talking about the start of services coordination, that person was actually a woman named Barbara Sackett, who did that with index cards and a folding table. And she happens to be the great-great-great-granddaughter of the woman in pink that's pictured in our rotunda. So if you go up and look at the mural in our rotunda, services coordination for IDDD came from that family.
Yeah. There you have it.
Kids, a
little bit of trivia. So first off, I just want to apologize to everyone that we weren't able to have come up and testify today. In a perfect world, we'd be able to have everyone come up and testify. So I apologize on behalf of the committee. We did stay a little bit later. I did take some folks out of order to try and get folks that were here that had traveled more than 100 miles. So I do apologize for that as well. But thank you all for your patience, and we're going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting. Thank you.